Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Busy week ahead of us. Lots to talk about. It's interesting, as the year kind of rockets here to an end, and as the Christmas season comes so fast upon us, that the rest of the world is hardly standing still. Just so much going on. And all you had to do was look at the nation's newspapers over the weekend to know that we are living in, yes, very, very confused times. The New York Times major article over the weekend on the gender line with children. Now, this is one of those stories that I've been tracking for some time precisely because I can't think of anything that probably serves as a better warning that we are falling or, even diving deeply into confusion when it comes to gender and sexuality. I wrote an article about this just back in October entitled Gender Confusion in the Kindergarten, and that was occasioned by the fact that there was a kindergarten in Oakland, California, and one in Broward County, Florida, that was allowing allowing children to present themselves as the opposite of their birth sex, of their biological sex, a little boy to dress like a girl, and vice versa if necessary. And this is a big story, as you could imagine. It's one thing to talk about cross-dressing adults. It's yet another thing to talk about cross-dressing children. And now there's an entire movement that is coalescing around this, calling for the rights of children to have sexual sex expression, self-expression, gender expression, going all the way down to youngest ages. The New York Times wrote this article, big story in the December 2 edition. It was entitled Supporting Boys or Girls When the Line Isn't Clear. And let's be clear about what line isn't clear here. It's the gender line, the line between boys and girls. Reporter Patricia Lee Brown explained, until recently, many children who did not conform to gender norms in their clothing or behavior and identified intensely with the opposite sex were steered to psychoanalysis or behavior modification. Period. Now, let me just say, a lot of those kids, by the way, had their behavior modified by peers and parents. It wasn't just that it was some kind of formal specialist in the therapeutic industry. But she goes on to write, but as advocates gain ground for what they call gender identity rights, evidenced most recently by New York City's decision to let people alter the sex listed on their birth certificates, a major change is taking place among schools and families. Children as young as 5 who display predispositions to dress like the opposite sex are being supported by a growing number of young parents, educators, and mental health professionals. How far are some of these people going? Well, the story is very clear that some parents are now allowing their children to experiment with this gender self-expression, gender identity rights, to the very point that in this confusion, some of the parents are using blocking drugs to prevent puberty until the child decides which way he or she wants to go. Lots of stuff here. The reporter, Patricia Lee Brown, admits the prospect of cross-dressing kindergartners has sparked a deep philosophical divide among professionals over how best to counsel families. Is it healthier for families to follow the child's lead or to spare children potential humiliation and isolation by steering them toward accepting their biological gender until they are older? Now, notice that they even condition that with until they are older. There's no conception here in the story about telling persons that their biological sex is their sex. Now, there are always, in stories like this, some interesting people cited. And in this one, boy, let me tell you, there are some interesting people. Tom Little, who is the director of the Park Day School in Oakland, California, that's one of the schools I covered before, explained that teachers at his school are taught a gender-neutral vocabulary and are told to line up children by sneaker color rather than gender. Sneaker color. All you with red sneakers here, black sneakers here, white sneakers here. We can't even talk about boys and girls anymore. One specialist cited in the article, Dr. Kenneth Zucker, who has treated about 500 children dealing with the issue, claims that 80% of these children grow out of it. And thus his approach is to help children, quote, be more content in their biological gender, end quote. But even Dr. Zucker said, until they reach a certain age. Dr. Edgardo Menville, who teaches at an institution near Washington, D.C., says the goal is for the child to be well-adjusted, healthy, and have good self-esteem. What's not important is molding their gender, end quote. I think there are an awful lot of parents who would find that a puzzling statement. What's not important is molding their gender. Now, as I say, there are some statements that just seem almost, almost impossible to believe. I mentioned Tom Little, who's director of the Park Day School in Oakland, California. Listen to what he says here about the kids in that school. And remember, you're talking about kindergartners and first graders, the very youngest of the young here. He says, we are careful not to create a situation where students are being boxed in. We allow them to move back and forth until something feels right. End quote. Now, you know, I just have to admit almost ideological paralysis at this. I mean, what do you say? What is the response to this? Once you're talking to someone who decides that it's appropriate for elementary age children to move in and out of sexual identities and gender identities until they find, however they think they're going to find, something that feels right, I don't know how you respond to that other than we have the biggest worldview clash that is here imaginable. And that's where we as Christians have to come back and say, it's not just that we believe that biology indicates gender. And, of course, the exception there would be for those who have ambiguous genitalia where biology is not conclusive. But that's not what's being addressed in this article. That is a biological rarity, and we would understand that for what it is. But when you're looking here at someone who is unquestionably male physically, who wants to be female, a boy who wants to be a girl, or vice versa, a girl who wants to be a boy, the Christian response is to come back and say, look, we've got the whole gender equation wrong if we think this is something imposed on us. Gender is one of God's gifts to us. It's one of the ways God shows us that he loves us and shows us how to glorify him. We are to embrace what he shows us in our gender, even in the physical constitution of our bodies, and we are to find how we glorify God in just that way. And we just have to know that our Creator made us this way for a purpose that is for our good and for his glory. The basic worldview divide is not over whether gender is just fixed or indeterminate. It's whether gender, that is the sex with which you're born, being male or female, is a gift or an imposition. I think that's an even more fundamental divide. You'll find my article on this topic entitled, When the Gender Line Isn't Clear? At Albert Moeller, that's MOHLER.com. And there's a link there immediately to Patricia Lee Brown's article. I think you ought to take a look at it. Not only parents, emphatically parents, but also all those who are interested in the future and in our children. Other big news over the weekend has to do with the issue of homosexuality. It seems always to be very close to the front lines, if not in the headlines. An Episcopal diocese in California, that is the Diocese of San Joaquin, right there in Central California, has overwhelmingly passed a series of resolutions that will allow it to secede from the Episcopal Church USA and to affiliate with the Global Anglican Communion and with the conservatives, Anglican traditionalists, that are there in the Anglican Communion. The Diocese of San Joaquin has 48 parishes and 7,000 members. And by the way, this is a conservative part of the heartland of California. In all the mainline Protestant denominations, United Methodism, the PCUSA, and all the rest, the judicatories right here in the midst of Central California tend to be quite conservative. And you have cities like Bakersfield and others there that are very much at the forefront of what's going on now in the schism in the Episcopal Church USA. The San Joaquin Diocese does not ordain women, has long been one of the most conservative of the ECUSA's 110 dioceses, and it was the election of an openly gay bishop and now the election of a woman as the presiding bishop of the church that has sparked this move to secede. Folks, this is huge. It's huge because there have been many churches and dioceses that have talked about doing this for years. But even with the ordination of women and so many other things, none actually did it. Well, history was made this past weekend when the Diocese of San Joaquin did it. They took a vote. They've appealed for alternative oversight to the Archbishop of Canterbury. They have to vote once again a year from now to make this final, according to their own charter, but they have made very clear this is what they intend to do. They may be quickly followed by two of the most famous churches in the Episcopal world, both of these located in metropolitan Washington, D.C., both in Fairfax County, Virginia. They are two of the United States' largest and most historic Episcopal congregations. They are the Truro Church and the Falls Church. Now, for instance, the Falls Church is where George Washington was himself a vestryman. So you're talking about two of the most evangelical and two of the churches with the largest memberships in the Episcopal Church USA. They are moving towards a similar vote. In this case, it's not the 193-congregation Virginia Diocese, which in this case is the largest diocese of the Episcopal Church, but rather it's these two churches. but you're talking about two churches that are among the centerpieces of Episcopal history in the United States. Folks, this tells us just how far these two groups have moved apart within the Episcopal Church USA. Interesting question, isn't it? Can you, within one denomination, accept two different positions on something as basic as homosexuality? When we come back, we're going to have a fascinating discussion about the fact that that's just what conservative Judaism is poised to do this week. Say yes and no to homosexuality. We're going to try to make sense of that when we come back, because there are lessons there not only for Judaism, but for Christian denominations as well, coast to coast, and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. All across this country and around the world, especially in the Western world, you will find groups struggling with the issue of homosexuality. And, of course, those who are tied to a biblical tradition here and a biblical authority have a particular issue when it comes to dealing with the issue of homosexuality. We're very familiar with how this plays out in the Christian world, but it's interesting. On the front page of the nation's newspapers this week, you're likely to read about a controversy relating to homosexuality in the Jewish world. This in one of the three major branches of Judaism, known as conservative Judaism. And the amazing thing about it is made clear in a Washington Post story that was released just in recent days that indicates that it looks like that conservative Judaism may come down and say that homosexuality is both right and wrong, both allowable and not allowable, both abhorrent and acceptable. I, for one, find that rather confusing, and there is no one better to clear up that confusion than the guest we have today, who is himself the president of the Union for Traditional Judaism, Rabbi Bruce Ginsburg of Congregation Sons of Israel in Woodmere, New York. Rabbi Ginsburg, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You'd want to know that my good friend Michael Medved and fellow Salem host colleague recommended you and your group, and I really appreciate you joining with me today.
I'm glad he made this connection.
Now, can you explain to me what's going on here? I know sometimes when we kind of look across the Jewish-Christian divide, you realize that the issues are the same and different. And, of course, many Christian denominations are struggling with the issue of homosexuality. But none, so far as I know, has officially decided the answer is yes and no. Is the Washington Post correct in stating that that's where it looks like conservative Judaism is going?
Yes, the Washington Post is correct in that regard. What should be understood is the Union for Traditional Judaism is a trans-denominational initiative, and so it's not as though I can speak on behalf of the conservative movement. But I can tell you that right now they are debating endorsing any one or two or three of five different papers, and it's quite possible that they will endorse two papers, one indicating that homosexuality is prohibited, and another if it would take a much more lenient view on the subject. So that may be confusing, but what you read is correct.
Now, I went to the website of the Union of Conservative Congregations, and in fact, the group, I believe the official name, is the Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. And there in a journal was an article by Rabbi Joseph Prusser, who is one of the major figures in this debate. And he makes something very interesting as an argument. This is on page 6 of his article. He says, "The proposed changes would result in legal incoherence unprecedented even in our famously pluralistic movement, a movement in which certain relationships are treated simultaneously by some worthy of sanctification and by others as violating biblical norms of the most profound gravity, evinces doctrinal anarchy, inviting ridicule from outsiders and dismissive contempt from those who seek our guidance." I have to say, as a Christian reading this essay, that makes a lot of sense.
I also believe it makes a lot of sense. I'm in agreement with him and with you.
Well, you know, we sometimes in the Christian world think of Judaism as one thing, and I know it's not, of course, and have friends who represent Orthodox, Reformed, Conservative Judaism, and I have engaged in theological discussions with some who are Reconstructionists. Conservative Judaism is the group that really emerged early in the 20th century, as I understand it, as a way to embrace both modernity and biblical law. Is that right?
You understand that very well.
Well, is this the problem? Is the problem? Well, let me put it this way. Let me make an argument and see if this is right. My reading of the situation is that you can't embrace modernity if that means endorsing homosexuality and maintain a fidelity to biblical law. It seems to me that that twin embrace doesn't work in this case.
Oh, well, let me say the following. Now, I do speak as the president of the Union for Traditional Judaism. We do believe it is possible to do the calculus of modernity and tradition. We do believe that it's possible to act with compassion for those who are challenged by homosexual impulses without overturning the very explicit biblical prohibition of homosexual behavior. I think we can recognize that there are some people who are more challenged than others, and I think it's possible to acknowledge the person's strengths along with his weaknesses. But I don't believe that within the context of Jewish law, both biblical and rabbinic, there's any way we could say that homosexual behavior is permissible or that we could sanctify it through commitment ceremonies or that people could serve as rabbis if they are professed homosexuals.
You know, the position you just articulated there, I think, is extremely close to where an informed evangelical Christian position would be, understanding that sin explains how any number of things could go wrong in terms of human sexual desire and reach out to those persons with compassion rather than condemning them, but make very clear that the behavior itself is still biblically rendered as sin. So I think we can understand that.
I think we're very much on the same page. I think in so many ways, people of faith, whatever denomination they belong to, find themselves in the struggle between their faith tradition and the challenges of modernity, in particular secularism. And I do believe that those people who have a sensitivity toward the good that has come with modernity, but nonetheless have a real commitment to their own faith tradition, are working hard to come up with a way to strike that balance. I believe that there are people like yourself in the evangelical community who are striving to do that, and certainly there are people like ourselves in the Union for Traditional Judaism to try to do the same.
Rabbi Elliot Dorf is cited in the L.A. Times as the rector of the University of Judaism in Bel Air, a well-known bioethicist, according to the article. He's writing the position paper to end the ban on the ordination of homosexuals and the blessing of same-sex unions. And this is fascinating to me, and I don't want to become too, I don't want to be too specific, actually, in what he argues here. But looking at his paper, he says that some forms of rabbinical teaching and prohibitions among homosexuals should be retained, but other sex acts would be allowed. Does that make sense to you?
No, it doesn't make sense to me because, as you know, Judaism has always held to what's known as the written Torah, that scripture as you know it, and rabbinic law, which is the Talmud and other documents. In terms of our tradition going back thousands of years, we really can't make a distinction between one and the other. I believe that he is trying to do precisely that in order to find an allowance for some homosexual behaviors. I believe that that's the weak point of his argument.
And again, on the evangelical side of this, we can see the same kind of argument being made, or the attempt at the same kind of argument being made in some of our circles as well. Rabbi Ginsburg, it seems to me that when you look at the Christian world right now and Christian denominations, it's clear that this issue has become one of the most significant dividing lines among us because it points to so many fundamental issues related to the interpretation of Scripture, biblical authority, and tradition and all the rest. Is this also what is happening in Judaism today? Is the debate among conservative Jewish rabbis an indication of the same phenomenon?
I think very much so. Once again, people within the conservative movement do have an attachment to their tradition wherever they stand within the spectrum. But where we find a challenge is that, of course, the Bible teaches us to be compassionate. So people find themselves between a rock and a hard place when they see very kind, loving people who seem to be living outside the parameters of Jewish law, and there are those that are striving to come up with a way to address that problem. Our question is whether one can do it within the parameters of Jewish law or not.
Well said. My guest today is Rabbi Bruce Ginsburg, president of the Union for Traditional Judaism and the rabbi at Congregation Sons of Israel in Woodmere, New York. Thank you for joining us, Rabbi. And folks, we'll be back with your calls at 877-893-8255. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. It's good to have Rabbi Bruce Ginsburg as my guest, and I think it was really important for us all to hear that because the same struggles take place on the Christian side of this equation. And especially when it comes to interpreting Old Testament texts, this is where we find a lot of common ground in terms of having to figure this out. And the kind of hermeneutical, that is, the kind of interpretive devices and theological approaches you find in the Christian world, you also find, obviously, here in the Jewish world. But this is still something almost new, at least in my understanding, because the debate in the mainline Protestant world is over whether to bless these unions or not to bless them. And what you have here, let me just read to you from a Washington Post story. Here is Erwin Kula, who is a conservative rabbi who heads the New York-based National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He says if they adopt the two positions, both that it's right and that it's wrong, if they say yes and no, this is what he says. He says that will be the strongest statement for America, because everything in America spiritually and religiously seems to become political, and the way you know it's political is that it's either yes or no. Can he be serious here? I mean, it's hard to believe that's even a serious statement. Is opposition to polygamy political just because it's yes or no? Is opposition to murder political just because it's yes or no? It's ridiculous. He goes on and he says, in a genuine spiritual tradition, yes and no are both living options. Both sides are right, and we're not used to that, because in a political reality, only one side can be right. End quote. Rabbi Kula, let me introduce you to Rabbi Moses. He did not come down with 10 yes or no's. It was 10 commandments, thou shalt and thou shalt not. And he wasn't playing politics. What's your response to a rabbi who says that in a genuine spiritual tradition, yes and no are both living options, both sides are right, and you just embrace them both? The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Calling from Brisbane, Australia is Jeff on the line. Jeff, you're listening
Hello, Albert.
On Tuesday as I'm speaking. I'm great. I just find it amazing. You're listening on Tuesday, and I'm speaking on Monday.
Yes, that's right. I'm listening here on the Internet. I'm just interested in this whole question of homosexuality as far as consistency here, because today we seem very much to want to do things the natural way, with the natural environment, with nature and that type of thing, work with it. And yet here we seem to have an issue of human sexuality where the natural way seems to be heterosexuality, and yet people seem to want to argue that homosexuality is perfectly natural, and yet there doesn't seem to be any natural basis for that. I find that hard to understand from wherever you're coming from.
Well, I think that's a very legitimate point, and by the way, the Apostle Paul points directly to that in Romans chapter 1 when he says that it takes an incredible creativity of a sinful sort, and Paul's very, very clear about that. An extreme creativity of a sinful sort, a rebellious sort, to work against nature. He actually uses that term, against nature, in order for women to abandon the natural use of the man, that's his terminology, and instead seek to express their sexuality with other women, and for men to burn with passion for each other. So you're making an argument that's not only based just in common sense and common grace and looking at the natural world, Jeff. You're making an argument that the Apostle Paul makes explicitly in Scripture. Thanks for calling from Australia. It's great to hear from you. Appreciate you listening there down under. Let's go to Lawrence calling in Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Yes, as I was listening to the conversation there, this reminded me of the time that the Pharisees said that Jesus was demon-possessed by Beelzebub, and that's how he was preaching. And he turned around and he had mentioned that a church divided against itself cannot stand, as in Beelzebub divided against himself cannot stand. This is what this is looking like to me. The church is divided, but yet it's going to stay together, and it's going to fail by keeping these teachings.
You know, what an interesting point to make, Lawrence. That's found, by the way, of course, in Matthew chapter 12, where Jesus is accused of casting out the demon by Beelzebub, the prince of the demons. And you're exactly right. Jesus comes back and says, look, a house divided against itself cannot stand. By the way, a lot of people think Abraham Lincoln said that. Lincoln is there quoting Jesus. But what was Lincoln's point? Lincoln's point was that the Union cannot survive half slave and half free. And he chose to quote Jesus on that, making very clear that you must choose to go one way or the other. And I think, Lawrence, you're exactly right. When it comes to the issue of homosexuality, there's no way to say we'll be yes here and yes there. We'll embrace yes and no. We'll accept that it's both sinful and sanctifying. I think the rabbi who said that is simply incoherent is exactly right. I want to know what you think. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Boy, it'd be convenient in this fallen world to answer questions like this with yes and no. It's just not right. Give me a call. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, I meant what I said to the rabbi. Every interpretive game you see being played right now in Judaism, you can find somewhere in Christianity, including this ludicrous suggestion that you ought to say yes and no at the same time to a question as important and unavoidable as the sinfulness, or just say the moral status of homosexuality. Right now, there's a raging debate in England taking place among some Christians. And it has to do with the fact that some of the major university ministries, the Christian unions at several of the British universities, are claiming discrimination because they're being denied the ability to function, they say, as explicitly Christian unions. And a group known as Ecclesia, kind of a left-leaning think tank in Great Britain, released a report just in the last week suggesting that the Christian unions ought not to fight this, and suggesting that one of the problems with the Christian unions on the campuses of these British universities is that they do not accept the principle of embracing homosexuality as normal. In other words, these Christian unions are teaching that homosexuality is a sin. That violates the diversity standards of these universities, and thus they say you can't be there. Now, I think that just points to the ludicrousness and, well, in this country, it would be the unconstitutionality of those rules. And of course, it's not unconstitutional in Great Britain. Britain doesn't even have a written constitution. But the interesting thing is that this left-leaning think tank advising these Christian unions said it really would be better for you to broaden your perspective on sexuality anyway to accept both positions, both that homosexuality is normal and that it is sinful. Now, you know, let's just think about this at the operational level for a moment. Let's forget we're talking about a denomination. Let's forget whether it's Jewish or Christian in this case. And let's not talk about the Christian unions of Great Britain. Let's just think about the local Christian church, the local Christian congregation. Can you say yes and no to this? Let's be clear about what's at stake. Here you have a human being, a Christian, trying to determine whether homosexuality is right or wrong. Is that a small question? No, it's a giant question. Because, first of all, it's a question about sin. The distinction between right behavior and wrong behavior in Scripture is extremely important. Because it's not just about doing those things that break the rules. It's about doing those things that rob God of His glory. An inadequate understanding of sin is one of the foundational problems in this debate. Once you understand that, then the next question is, how important, when talking about sin, is homosexuality? Well, it's important at two levels. Number one, at the scriptural level, Paul tells us that homosexual behavior is itself perhaps even the classic example of where sinfulness leads. Read Romans 1. That's the essence of his argument. Sin leads even to this depth of confusion. Homosexual acts are, the biblical word is, an abomination. In this politically correct age, there's even some Christians who have never heard that. An abomination is a thing that is so awful that God cannot even stand the concept. At the second level, operationally and pragmatically, in terms of the individual lives of persons who will give themselves to homosexual behavior, and then the families and the circle of friends and all the rest, homosexuality becomes disruptive to the entire human circle, to the entire human culture, the human society. It rearranges things so that the natural order is replaced with the unnatural order, leading to inevitable consequences. So it's not a small question. It's an important question. You know, the other thing we would have to ask is it a question that is directly answered in Scripture? There's the Scripture principle. In other words, is this something that Scripture leaves unanswered? Is there in Scripture a yes or a no? If someone came up to me and said, what is the biblical answer to this question? Should I buy a typewriter or a computer? I have no answer. There is no proof text in Scripture. This is not a scriptural issue. This is what Christian ethicists call adiaphorus. That means there's no right answer. Now, in a context, prudence may indicate, and scriptural principles may indicate, better stewardship here, better utility here, but there's nothing wrong with buying a typewriter. There's nothing that robs God of his glory in buying a computer rather than the typewriter. So there is no movement right now to normalize the buying of a typewriter or a computer, because why? It's not an important moral issue. And Scripture doesn't address it directly. But when it comes to homosexuality, Scripture most emphatically does address it directly, repeatedly. And it addresses it comprehensively. I mentioned that I had downloaded some articles that are very much at the center of this debate in conservative Judaism. And it really is interesting stuff. But the citation that I made earlier from this rabbi is the one that I think gets to the heart of the issue. This is Rabbi Joseph Prusser. And remember, this is being debated right here this week in America. The decision is to come this week. He says, and again, I think this word is just so eloquent. He says the proposed changes, that is to say yes and no, would result in legal incoherence unprecedented even in our famously pluralistic movement. In other words, this rabbi is saying pluralism has its limits. He said a movement in which certain relationships are treated simultaneously by some as worthy of sanctification and by others as violating biblical norms of the most profound gravity evinces doctrinal anarchy, inviting ridicule from outsiders and dismissive contempt from those who seek our guidance. Let me tell you why I think that's so eloquent. It's because he says, look, let's just be really honest about what our group, our movement, is now contemplating. Allowing some to say that homosexual relationships lead to sanctification, and others saying that it leads to God's judgment. Folks, those are two absolutely diametrically opposed moral judgments. What do you do if this is the advice you get? Flip a coin? Roll the dice? Go with your instinct? This is a reminder to those of us who are not Jews but Christians, not a part of the conservative Jewish debate, that is the debate in conservative Judaism, but rather involved in the debates in our own circles, congregations, denominations, institutions, and on and on. On an issue of this importance, we dare not say that we do not know. On an issue of this importance, we dare not say yes and no. We just must respond with moral clarity. I was fascinated that Rabbi Ginsburg said that his movement's really trying to balance compassion and truth. And, you know, that's where we all are. We're trying to balance compassion and truth. But let's remember that it is not compassionate to lie to persons about the moral status of their behavior. Knowledge is power, Francis Bacon said. Yes, and the conviction of sin is a first step towards dealing with it. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back, folks. Interesting discussion. Great to have Rabbi Ginsburg on, and it's a reminder to us that even though we live in the precinct of our beliefs in the evangelical world, the patterns of thinking and the basic questions raised are not just raised within our circles. It's very interesting to see how other groups are dealing with this. And, of course, this is one of the reasons why watching the Catholic world and watching the Jewish world can give us some education. And how some people are trying to negotiate around the scriptural text. Some people are trying, to say both yes and no simultaneously. I'm finding, by the way, the experiment over at On Faith at the Washington Post and Newsweek magazine to be very, very interesting. And the three articles that I've submitted have all received a good deal of attention. This week, we're going to be talking about something very different, and that has to do with mixed-faith families and Christmas and Hanukkah and the holidays. I'm going to have something distinctively evangelical to offer to that discussion, but I want to come back to something that was raised by a writer who came back and took issue with my very first column. When I said that, that real dialogue takes place when we believe that the other, we respect that the other is speaking from deep conviction. And in other words, I said that we must respect the fact that these beliefs are sincerely held. I had a writer write back and say, how can you say that we should respect these other beliefs? These other beliefs lead not to heaven, but to hell. They lead not to salvation, but to confusion. They lead not to light, but to darkness. Well, number one, legitimate point, but that's not what I said. As a matter of fact, I can't enter into a dialogue where I'm told I have to respect every other position. If you really believe that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one can come to the Father but by him, then you can't respect any way other than that. But this is the issue, and this is what I wrote. I said you can respect the fact that the other's beliefs are sincerely held. That is the key to an effective and genuine conversation of integrity. I have to believe that the person who is telling me what he or she believes really believes what he or she is saying. I can respect the fact that they genuinely believe this to be true. That doesn't mean I respect the idea any more than I would demand that they respect mine. It does mean that we respect the fact that we genuinely believe these things to be true. Otherwise, we would not be engaging in this conversation. That's the kind of respect we need. It's respect for the other person and for the other person's integrity of thought, not with the ideas that are held or being advocated or argued in any particular dialogue. Lots of confusion out there about whether dialogue is possible. It's not possible if we have to accept the rules of the postmodern world, but it is possible if we respect each other as sincerely believing what we believe and speaking honestly to each other. That in itself is dialogue. For that matter, it's Christian witness. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about a massive problem in the evangelical church, and that's plagiarism in the pulpit. Would your preacher lie or steal? I'll meet you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.